The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
Award along with two other incredible athletes, basketball's Kobe Bryant and football's Peyton Manning. We all stood on stage together and watched the highlights of our careers with the cameras rolling and the fans cheering. And I looked around and I had a moment of extreme awe. I felt so grateful to be there, included in the company of Kobe and Peyton. I had a momentary feeling of having arrived, like we women had finally made it. Then, the applause ended, and it was time for the three of us to exit stage left. And as I watched those men walk off the stage, it dawned on me that the three of us were stepping into very different futures. Each of us, Kobe, Peyton, and I, we made the same sacrifices. We shed the same amount of blood, sweat, and tears. We'd left it all on the field for decades with the same ferocity, talent, and commitment. But our retirements wouldn't be the same at all. Because Kobe and Peyton walked away from their careers with something I didn't have. Enormous bank accounts. And because of that, they had something else I didn't have. Freedom. Their hustling days were over, and mine were just beginning. Later that night, back in my hotel room, I laid in bed and thought, this isn't just about me, and this isn't just about soccer. We talk a lot about the pay gap. We talk about how we, overall, U.S. women, earn 80 cents for every dollar paid to men. Black women in America earn 63 cents, while Latinas earn 54 cents for every dollar paid to white men. What we need to talk more about is the aggregate and compounding effects the pay gap on women's lives. Over time, the pay gap means women are able to invest less and save less, so they have to work longer. When we talk about what the pay gap costs us, let's be clear. It costs us our very lives.
That was retired soccer player Abby Wambach at the Bernard commencement last year. Needless to say, on the podcast, we'll discuss the wage gap in professional sports. How can it happen? Why does it happen? What are the fixes insofar as they may exist? These are all some of the questions we'll tackle. As with all hotly debated and often polarizing topics like this, there are strong opinions, and understandably so. This is an important topic, and it does mirror similar issues in the real world. My goal, however, is to seduce people out of their echo chambers and request that they look at the issue objectively, regardless if you think you have everything related to this issue figured out. Chances are, you'll find that you don't have it all figured out. And as you'll hear in the podcast, this is an immensely complicated issue. It's not just, as some proclaim, simply a matter of supply and demand and revenue generation and such. So to help unpack it all, I have two distinguished economists, Dr. Nola Aga and Dr. Jill Harris. Two economists that have a very broad research agenda in sports economics. It's important to understand how privileged we are to get the perspective of these two economists. As you probably know, economics is itself is a very male-dominated field. And economists that have a background in sports economics are hard to find. So these incredible women are a subset of a subset. And our listeners will be incredibly fortunate to get both of their perspective, not only as sports economists, but also as women who may have been competitive athletes themselves or may have a daughter or future granddaughters that may be competitive athletes. So let's get into some quick bios. Professor Aga is an economics professor at the University of San Francisco. She teaches courses in research methods and strategic management and previously taught sport finance and sport economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She worked in international business operations for several years and has also consulted to the sport and fitness industry by conducting economic impact studies, competitive analysis, feasibility studies for clients in Major League Baseball, the NBA, minor league hockey, and local organizing committees and fitness organizations. She studies public goods and externalities, the economic impacts of teams and stadiums, the efficiency and equity outcomes of stadium subsidies, and a variety of issues related to minor league baseball. She's won numerous awards, and it's my understanding that Professor Aga was also quite the competitive runner in her day as well. Professor Harris is an economics professor at the United States Air Force Academy. Her research is focused on cheating behavior in the NCAA. She enjoys teaching introductory economics as well as economics of sport and economics of crime. She has an extensive research publication list in topics of sport economics, including state of play, how do college football programs compete for student athletes, as well as if you can't pay them, play them, fan preferences and own race bias in the WNBA. She's a military spouse and has three children. And because Dr. Harris works for the United States Air Force Academy, we have to add the disclaimer that the thoughts and opinions of Professor Harris are her own and don't reflect that of the opinions of the United States Air Force Academy. So we get into just about everything on the topic, including the women's national team class action lawsuit. While we do discuss the differences in revenue generation at the level of the United States Soccer Federation and FIFA, we also get at the structural issues and uneven playing conditions between the men's and women's teams. In the end, I get Dr. Harris and Dr. Aga's take on what would they do if they had the chance to use their broad knowledge of sports economics, labor issues, econometrics, and such to improve the issue. So, without further delay, I give you Dr. Jill Harris and Dr. Nola Aga. I'm joined today with Dr. Jill Harris and Dr. Nola Aga. Thank you for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, pleased to be here.
All right. So on this podcast, we're going to discuss the wage gap in professional sports by taking a close look at the U.S. women's national team, who just won the World Cup after another stellar year. Congratulations to them. And so, you know, although this is not a new issue, which has been dubbed the grass ceiling, the U.S. women's national team win and subsequent lawsuits boosted the issue back into the spotlight. So the aim is to unpack the economics or the other idiosyncrasies that influence this issue and try to demystify the wage gap for the listener using the U.S. women's national team as an example. So extremely fortunate to have a conversation with Dr. Harris and Dr. Aga, two economists that are uniquely qualified to discuss and unpack the economics of this issue. And insofar that there is a solution that makes all parties happy, what would that be? And so sort of keeping that question in the back of our heads. So for our listeners, I'm going to start by just doing some quick introductions and give our listeners a high-level understanding of your expertise, your education, and background in the research of sport economics. How about we start with Dr. Harris?
Sure, thanks. So I am an economist, which usually shuts down all modes of communication between us and other humans. But I'm fond of saying that I'm not economics. We've earned the reputation of kind of promoting the dismal science, and I like to say that I'm one of the perkier dismal scientists that you might have a conversation with. So for formal training, my undergraduate degree was in economics, went and got a master's degree in the UC system, UC Riverside, in financial economics, but didn't start studying my ultimate area of interest until I got to Oklahoma State University. That's where I completed my PhD, and my original dissertation research was on the NCAA, and I developed in that dissertation an idea that at the time was fairly novel, but now is fairly mainstream, that the NCAA, although it promotes and does a lot of great things in the world of amateur sport, in its behaviors it acts somewhat like a cartel. Mm-hmm. So that initial dissertation project kind of set the course for a large part of the research I've engaged in as an economist. I've written on the NCAA, on its behaviors, especially with respect to student athlete labor. And from that work, I went on to join an organization that both Dr. Ag and I belong to, the North American Association of Sports Economists. And that's where I met one of my future co-authors, Dr. David Berry, and he and I have written together on the WNBA, on, in particular, draft picks and performance evaluation in the WNBA, and also a little bit on discrimination in the WNBA when it comes to playing time. But I've also done some work on matching markets, how do athletes choose the schools they want to play for, and then again, some other topics related to the NCAA. So that gives you a little bit of a background from me. Right. and what I've chosen to kind of invest in the world of sport.
Excellent. All right. Great. Dr. Aga?
So I'm a little bit different than Dr. Harris. My PhD is actually in management, but I graduated from a school of management with a focus area in economics, and specifically in sport economics. My passion and my interest has always been around public policy. And where that intersects with sport economics for most of my past has been in the area of public financing for stadiums. So to me, this is a classic redistributional issue in economics, which is we take public money and we build these very expensive stadiums, and in the process, we distribute public money to wealthy private owners. So in the past couple years, I've taken that same sort of passion for these social injustices and have started looking more at wage and gender issues in the context of sport. So the passion point is the same, which is that we see these unequal distributions in our society, and part of that can be wages, but part of that can also be this very large stadium subsidy game that we play.
I see. Okay. Wow. Well, I feel really dumb. I took micro and macro at BC and didn't do too well in it. But your backgrounds are impressive and certainly uniquely qualified to have this discussion. And, you know, economics in itself is, you know, primarily male dominated. There aren't many women in the field, and particularly that have expertise in sport economics. So the intersection of all of these complicated topics, I'm sure will drive home in the discussion, you know, based upon your expertise and your background and your research agenda. So how about we start here? So the polarization on this issue is, you know, pretty substantial. You have on the one hand the claims that this is 100% sexism, and then on the other side of the spectrum, the claim that this has nothing to do with sexism. This is 100% driven by market forces. So I think that's where the spectrum, the endpoints of the spectrum lie, and I suspect that the truth probably lies somewhere in between, where people like economists and data scientists can help unpack that. So I want to get both of your opinions on this. Do you see this as purely a economic issue, a social issue, or both? Whoever wants to go.
I'll weigh in first. I see it as both. Mm-hmm. Surely it is an issue of microeconomics. Mm-hmm. We spend a great deal of time teaching our undergrads about market forces, about how those market forces work when conditions of pure competition exist, and we would expect to see wages for all laborers that reflect what we call marginal revenue product, which is just the joint kind of multiplication of what a laborer generates in productivity multiplied by the additional revenue for the organization that productivity creates. So we would expect to see, and we teach our undergraduates, that in a perfectly competitive labor market, you'd expect a laborer to earn a wage that reflects this marginal revenue product. Now, that gets complicated when the markets are less than perfect. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's taken micro or macro probably studied some of those market imperfections as well. But this question on the issue of the U.S. women's national team certainly has these kind of microeconomic underpinnings. But I also think that it's a social issue, and that they clearly have used the resources available in our society to make a claim that they're not being treated according to kind of fairness and equity principles that are present in our legal system. So, and that's broader than any microeconomic mm-hmm. Theory or model. That is an issue that is kind of ubiquitous across sport and other industries. So if I had to, I don't know what percentage I would give, you know, how much is this a social issue versus a purely economic issue, but I'm convinced that it's both.
Interesting.
I mean, I certainly agree. If you look at just the general workplace, we know that women are paid less than men across virtually all industries and all segments of society. So based on that alone, we can say that there are a lot of social factors at play here that, you know, affect the average worker. We also know that there's a much larger pay disparity in sport than there is in general society, and whether that's we're looking at payouts in golf, whether we're looking at wages in basketball, that the disparities in sport are much larger than the 70 or 80 cents a dollar that the average female works. And so the other layer that goes on top of this is also that we're dealing with a nonprofit organization. So right. The U.S. Soccer Federation is technically a nonprofit, but it has a very unique mission to to increase participation, spectator appeal, and to make soccer sort of the preeminent sport in America. And that's a very unique mission that they have. And that mission is supposed to be soccer as a whole. It's not supposed to be gender specific. So I think that's important social context to lay on top of this discussion as we go through.
I see. Okay. So they win the U.S. women's national team wins the World Cup, and then we get news of the lawsuit that was filed, a class action lawsuit. And just to set the tempo for the class action lawsuit, so they make the, just to give a little bit of numbers here, they say under the pay structure that went into effect through December 2008, men's national team players received a minimum, currently about $5,000, to play each game regardless of the outcome, win or lose. And so the minimum can increase to amounts currently ranging from $6,250 to $17,625, depending upon the level of their opponent and whether they win or tie a game. And so just to put that into perspective, they're saying that the pay for women is approximately 38% of the compensation of a similarly situated men's national team player. So about 38% less. So just to underscore what you were saying about the wage gap being bigger than the actual wage gap in the world with general people. So let's talk about the class action lawsuit. What do you know about it, and can you give some background on whether or not lawsuits like this have any impact in professional sports?
Whew, yeah. So two things I think that that anybody who wants to participate in this conversation should kind of have in their minds is that well, it's straightforward to say that the women are making less. When you look at the claims and the responses so far in the lawsuit, you can't really get into the detail of the claims and the responses without understanding that, and you alluded to this, that the collective bargaining agreements that the men and women have are themselves different. So as Nola alluded to earlier, there's layers here. There's lots of layers. But I think in its essence, what this lawsuit is trying to get to is that, in effect, the women, given their collective bargaining agreement, the women have to, in a sense, outperform the men in order to earn what you described, Tony, as this 38% less. They have to outperform the men. In fact, the men earn more for a loss than the women earn for a win. Mm-hmm. And that this is the inequity, regardless of how the dollars and cents are distributed, this is the inequity that they're trying to address. So, the second part of your question, do lawsuits like this, are they effective? Without citing chapter and verse of some of the cases that our colleagues have written about, they have been effective, mm-hmm. but it typically is more of a long run game. It's clearly not the shortest route to equal pay or pay that reflects the value of these players. Mm-hmm. But there's precedent for these types of actions in the past, and I think that's why the women leveraging their victory, leveraging the fact that they have been outperforming the men recently, spectacularly.
Right.
They're capturing kind of the public imagination, and they're using their victories and their performance as leverage, even though they have a new collective bargaining agreement that is an improvement over their former one. They haven't closed the gap completely. Right. And that's the issue that they're taking to the Federation via the courts.
Right.
So maybe something else to add here is to consider that the lawsuit was not just about paying. It was also about unequal playing conditions.
Right.
And claims that the women's team were given fewer resources in order to promote the game, in order to market the game. When the games were put on, there was, for example, lower ticket prices, which then in effect reduces the ultimate revenues of the organization when it looks like it's coming from the women's side. So that as we think about and as the conversation moves towards more specifics on the actual components of the wages and what women are being paid, that those in some ways are a function of the way the organization is structured and the decisions that it makes in order to try and monetize the women's events.
Mm-hmm.
The recent Women's World Cup is a really good example of that. I was not there in person, but I saw plenty of reports on social media that there was very few items to buy. Merchandise, if you wanted a t-shirt or a keychain, that there was very little to buy.
Right.
That there was a poor attempt by FIFA to even maximize their revenue from a merchandise standpoint for the women's game. And so it speaks to this larger societal problem, this larger structural problem of not investing in the game,
right,
and therefore not profit maximizing from it. And so the lawsuit attempts to bring those things together to say, listen, we want equal pay for the work that we're doing. If I kick a ball for 90 minutes, then I would like to be compensated equally as the men that are kicking a ball for 90 minutes. But the way to do that and to achieve that equity is also to make sure that on the back end business side, we're doing the equal effort to, you know, profit maximize on both sides. So that's, I think, an important context also for the CBA.
Right. Yeah, I saw a lot of that. I did read the lawsuit, and there was items in the lawsuit about charter flights. For instance, the men had charter flights, and they didn't have charter flights. Playing, the men would play on grass versus the women for some time were forced to play on AstroTurf. I think they corrected that.
Yes.
And then the women were playing more games. They were playing more, and oftentimes the field conditions, regardless of where they were playing, weren't as good. So you're right. There were other things that were red flags to me in reading the lawsuit, which led me to say, you know, how could this happen? And there seems to be something between the U.S. Soccer Federation, a difference between what the U.S. Soccer Federation is doing, and then FIFA and World Cup revenue, which we'll get into that. But some of these conditions, absolutely, to me, the way they were stated were certainly just outrageous. So maybe there is something there. If something doesn't change with the actual pay, perhaps almost certainly there can be something done with some of those issues. So let's talk about the revenue side of the equation. And so, as I stated in the beginning, you know, some of the people who are on one side of the spectrum of this conversation will always talk about revenue. Men just simply bring in more revenue is the statement that's often made. What do you know about this, the sources of revenue, and how that impacts either the money they get from the U.S. Soccer Federation Well, let's talk about the U.S. Soccer Federation first. I think we could probably handle FIFA separately.
Sure. Yeah, it's. I think it's important to distinguish those two because they do intertwine at some point. But the U.S. Soccer Federation receives about half of its revenue from sponsorships and media deals. And those, the way that they are reported in their financial statements, there's no way to distinguish whether those are from the women's national team or the men's national team.
Mm-hmm.
About a quarter of the revenue comes from games.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about that, there's some more important details in there. So the games are from the women's national team and the men's national team.
Got it.
There are tournaments that U.S. soccer puts on specifically themselves. And then even though there's revenues, even though 25% of their revenues is coming from games, realize that not all games have the same expenses. And so not every game is equally profitable. So that's that net gain for each of the games can muddle this at some point. But that 25% of the revenue, when you break it down between the women's and the men's side, it's primarily ticket sales.
Mm-hmm.
The bulk of it is ticket sales and then some local sort of sponsorships. Now, in recent years, because the men's national team hasn't had the same success as the women's team, there has been payment by the opposing team to have the men's national team play. And so in this case, when you see revenue coming in from a men's national team game, it doesn't always mean that that's ticket sales, that it doesn't always reflect the demand for the game. It can sometimes reflect that there was an opposing team that wanted to pay that. So it's messy, but we do know that as a whole, the U.S. Soccer Federation gets about a quarter of the revenue from these games. And then the final 25%, these are dues. So any national governing body is going to charge dues, whether you're the U.S. Judo Federation or table tennis. So small dues from each of its members, from everyone who plays association soccer in the U.S. They have fees for coaching schools, from some playing camps that they have, the player development camps. And then this is also merchandising revenue. So according to their financial statements, they receive merchandise royalties from Nike. In the fiscal year ending in 2017, that was about $3 million in royalties for mm-hmm. the merchandise. In the year ending fiscal year 2018, that increased to $5.2 million. And given that there's these reports of Nike selling record numbers of U.S. women's national team jerseys, I expect that number to be much larger mm-hmm. in the coming years.
I got it. So 50% sponsorships, 25% revenue from games, and 25% dues. And so there doesn't seem to be a big revenue disparity between the men and the women's leagues, which leads me to believe that, you know, perhaps much of the issue has to do with the CBA, which we can talk about. But are you seeing a big disparity between men's and women's revenue?
In recent years, no. So there was a report that came out recently from the Wall Street Journal. They went through and they looked at the women's and the men's earnings for the past 3 years, and they came to this sort of headline-busting conclusion that the women's national team is making more money by a really small margin. If you look at it over the past 5 years, you'll see that it does vary.
Mm-hmm.
As early as 2014, 2015, the men's team was making significantly more than the women's team.
Mm-hmm.
But some of that has to do with the Men's World Cup earnings in 2014. It also has to do with how the games were marketed. So the revenues vary sometimes dramatically by year, depending on which events are happening in that year. We do know for certain, though, in the last 3 years, the women have been making essentially the same, if not $1 million or $2 million more per year than the men in terms of games.
Got it. Okay. All right. So with that, I mean, so all of the people, at least on the level of the U.S. Soccer Federation, at least recently, the revenue gap has closed a little bit, and it seems like the people that would argue that there is a big revenue disparity at least don't have as strong of an argument, at least in recent years. So let's talk about the CBA. For the listeners who don't know anything about a collective bargaining agreement, how that works, and the outcome of negotiations, can you unpack that for us and help us explain, you know, what's a collective bargaining agreement?
They are as complicated as the organization and the players want them to be. But essentially, it's just what the name implies. Mm-hmm. The players have found that their strength in numbers, right? So instead of having to try to negotiate what's best for themselves individually, there's power in approaching the federation or their employer as a group. So in any negotiation process, both sides might have their needs and wants, and as a group, they designate who's going to represent those to the opposing side, and there's back and forth until there's an agreement. And it's an iterative process. There's timelines on these agreements. As you mentioned earlier, the revenue figures we were quoting and talking about, the 38%, were actually based on the terms of the collective bargaining agreement that had ended in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the new collective bargaining agreement changed things up a little bit. And that one just took effect in April of 2017. So that, you know, these agreements are fluid. They can change as the needs of the team and the needs of the employer change. But I think the big takeaways that are important for this conversation is that, again, the men's and women's collective bargaining agreements, even though the women's has improved, they still have very different components. For example, one instance of that is the way that the women agree to be paid, with a base salary plus bonuses, whereas the men's collective bargaining agreement is largely based on bonuses.
Got it. Yeah.
So, and we don't have to go into all the minutiae of the differences between women's and men's compensation schemes, but there needs to be some general understanding that under the new collective bargaining agreement with the women, some of the players on the team fare better than others. When you get down to, for example, comparisons between, say, the top 10% of men, top 10% of women, the disparity there isn't as great, say, when we get to the lower, say, 5 or 10% of the team. So understanding some of the nuances in the CBA helps us to appreciate the differences on a player-by-player basis that the women and the men experience. So I just want to back up just a little bit. There was, what's her name, Meg Kelly, who works on the fact checker for the Washington Post. She kind of summarized with this new CBA using what we were alluding to earlier, this kind of 20-game scenario. If you took the 20 friendly matches with the men, 20 friendly matches with the women, and calculated what the players would make, with the new collective bargaining agreement, she kind of fact-checked that the women's team would earn a little over $28,000 less,
right,
or 89% of the compensation of a similarly situated men's team.
Right.
And so what that establishes is that these CBAs, this newest one is an improvement, but obviously it clearly hasn't closed the gap completely. And some of the items that Dr. Aga was getting into on the revenue side help us to understand why that gap may not completely go away.
Interesting. So when you dig into the numbers, the men who have a bonus structure versus the women who have primarily a salary structure is, you know, mainly the result of that gap, would you say?
Yes. The fundamental differences in the way that they've agreed to receive compensation.
Right.
And it's interesting because a colleague, well, kind of a mutual colleague of ours, Michael McCann, is a law professor, and he writes for a number of media outlets, has kind of said that basically the women have agreed to the best worst agreement they can get. Right? they can't forego collective bargaining, but in the end, they can't walk away completely from the bargaining table. They can't refuse the best that their negotiators get for them. So in a sense, they end up kind of with the second best solution.
And again, the context here was also, as they were negotiating this, so the deal was signed in 2017 for the 3 years prior, the men's team had earned more in two of those 3 years than the women's team had. And so it was a period of time, you know, if you imagine the negotiators at the table at that point, where things were starting to change. You know, and so if they were looking at the past 3 years of numbers as they were negotiating this contract, they would have said, well, listen, the men's team has pulled in much more than the women's team for the last couple of years. And so you also think about the leverage that that somebody has on the table at that time. And so at that time, and the arguments we continue to hear are that how much you pay should in some ways be a function of how much you earn.
Right.
Which, you know, if we get into U.S. labor laws, that's not necessarily true. And it's something we can definitely delve into later. But, you know, so even then, this best worst agreement that they came to, that realized that not all of the women's national teams are salaried. That's only for 18 of the 28 players on the team.
Oh.
The other 10 players are actually very similar to the men's, which is they get no base salary. They only get these appearance fees. And actually that number is going to change every year in the contract. And so fewer and fewer women on the national team will be getting these base salaries. So for those, if you look at those women that aren't getting that base salary, their appearance fee is $3,500, whereas the same appearance fee for the men's team is going to be $5,000. So again, it's really hard to look one-to-one and to compare these things because there's so many variables that are different between the two. But if we do look at that same class of worker, the non-salaried national team player, the women are earning less, you know, per appearance than the men are. And so it's these sort of fundamental and small details that the women are drawing attention to, trying to say, listen, when there is a one-to-one comparison, there is a strong difference between the men and the women.
Right. And unpacking the number, I'm pretty good with numbers. And I saw the challenge with trying to do a one-to-one comparison. I mean, even trying to break out a spreadsheet and trying to do it mathematically, it's pretty complicated. So what about, is it possible that they could set the algorithm or the way that the compensation works, setting that completely equal, so a sort of one-for-one collective bargaining agreement that's just the same regardless of the human? Is that possible?
In a perfect world, sure, that's what you would want to see, right? You would want to see that your employees are paid the same for the same work regardless of their gender. But what complicates this is, of course, that there are two separate players' unions mm-hmm. that U.S. Soccer Federation has to negotiate with. Until both of those player unions decide to negotiate collectively as a whole, I don't think there's a realistic way to come up with that equal system.
Interesting.
Jill, do you have a different thought on that?
No, and I would, I don't know if it's appropriate to interject this here, but one of the things as an economist that always gives me pause, whether I read it in a news report or I hear it when pundits and others are talking about this issue, or if I'm just having a conversation with colleagues, there seems to be people tend to use this language kind of interchangeably. They'll say, well, the women's team should get equal pay to the men, you know, and they'll argue that this is what this lawsuit is about. But then you'll also sometimes hear or read that people will make this claim, well, the women should be paid what they're worth. And and what I kind of bristle at is this assumption that those two things are the same. I would err on the side of saying that what this lawsuit is about or should be about, or what the union for the women should be advocating, is that the women, in fact, would be paid what they're worth. And we as economists, not necessarily Nola and myself, but certainly some of our colleagues, one of our co-authors that we have in common, Dave Barry in particular, has developed a model that helps us figure out what the value of a player is pretty well based on how their efforts on the basketball court or the pitch contribute to wins. And so I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but it's related to what we're talking about. The women, I think most recently, if we applied all of our economic forces about player performance and impact on wins and impact on revenues, I think we'd find that the women, the value of the women's performances far exceeds the value of the male performances. So, you know, the union and the women may want to recalibrate their argument to say, you know, let's be paid what we're worth, because that may be, collective bargaining agreements aside, that may be much higher than what the men are paid.
Right.
So that just gets to Nola's point that it's until the unions agree to maybe, take a step back, hire some analysts that can come in and figure out what should the algorithm be? What is the metric that we're using to evaluate performance by players, contributions to wins by players, and therefore, you know, contributions to revenue? And if they did that without regard to gender, I would make a prediction that after the gender of the players was revealed, that we would see the women most recently should have been paid more.
Yeah. Interesting, right? So that's data science, that's econometrics, right? So I think that this is a data science problem, and I have a background in data science. And I think, if you get some data scientists together and you get people like you who understand econometrics, an algorithm could be developed to exactly what you're talking about. What's the marginal contribution of a human's efforts to pay, and perhaps that might be one way to do it. So this marrying to revenue streams may not work. So the mixed martial arts, Ronda Rousey, when Ronda Rousey was at the top of her sport, she was getting paid more than the men, and people would comment on this wage gap issue with her, and she would be very vocal about the fact that she was the highest paid fighter, male or female.
We've got quite a large pay dispute happening with our Australian women's soccer team at the moment. Is it frustrating for you as someone who's so prominent in your sport, and we heard you say on the Ellen show the other day you are the richest fighter in UFC, that sort of thing is still going on?
I think that how much you get paid should have something to do with how much money you bring in. I'm the highest paid fighter, not because Dana and Lorenzo wanted to do something nice for the ladies. They do it because I bring in the highest numbers. They do it because I make them the most money. And I think that the money that they make should be proportionate to the money that they bring in.
She would say, look, I'm bringing in the most revenue. So that's one instance that the revenue streams may work in your favor, but it sounds like you could live by it or die by it. It's sort of feast or famine, right? So,
that's actually an interesting point when you think about that feast or famine
So one of the things that we haven't delved a huge amount into yet is this idea that a lot of the revenue from in World Cup years can come from FIFA.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, when we think about the inequitable sort of social structures, one of which is that FIFA pays out, the multiplier is ridiculous, that about $30 million for the women's tournament, about $400 million for the men's tournament.
Right.
And so in that year, men's team that makes it to the World Cup, but for example, loses the first round, is probably going to earn more than a women's team that wins the World Cup. But because of the structural inequities in the system above the U.S. Soccer Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where it gets also tricky, this idea of, what are you worth? What are you worth needs to not be determined by something like FIFA, who has arbitrarily come up with these values for the tournament and for the winners. But to think about it in the context, again, I mentioned U.S. labor law earlier, which is, equal pay for equal work is a common mantra. And so when you think about two accountants that are sitting and working for any company, no one says, listen, who brought in more money this year? They say, listen, do you have equal degrees? Do you have equal years of experience? Are you doing relatively equal work? If so, then, your pay should be equal. And so that's where when we say, what are you worth? And this is this very important question of what are you worth? It needs to not be a function of the U.S. Soccer Federation's revenues from different sources. It needs to be a function of the marginal revenue product that Jill was mentioning earlier, mm-hmm. which is, what are you worth to your organization? Right? Are you selling 100 times more jerseys than somebody before? Are you generating revenues that are in excess of someone else in the organization because of your productivity or because of your success? And that's where this line gets blurred. I think it's really easy for people to look at it and be like, oh, well, the men earn more from FIFA, therefore they should take that money directly for themselves.
Right.
Instead of looking at it as an organization, which is the women's team and the men's team have a single employer, and that single employer has a duty to pay according to the skills, the work, and the productivity of their workers.
Right. Yeah, so you mentioned FIFA. Let's unpack that for the listeners. So I have some numbers here, and I think you have the same ones. So for the 2018 Men's World Cup, they had $6 billion in revenue, and they dished out the team share of $400 million. So that's a little less than 7%. The most recent Women's World Cup is estimated at about $131 million, and the team share was approximately $30 million. So that's approximately a 23% payout. So when you look at the revenue numbers at the World Cup level, $6 billion for the men, $131 million for the women. So that is a big disparity in revenue generated at the World Cup level. So, but again, it's like, what we're talking about. You could live by revenue or die by revenue. In this case, a substantial amount of revenue is going to the men's World Cup. But even though the viewership in the Women's World Cup, I think it's higher, substantially higher in recent years. So, yeah, I think this is part of the challenge here. Is how are you going to be? Are you going to be tied to revenue, or are you going to try to come up with a better way of figuring out the marginal contribution of a human's impact to the sport and how they should be paid. So do similar economic forces drive the NBA and a WNBA? I'm just curious about that, because if what we're saying is that let's say we come up with a new algorithm to understand the marginal contribution of a player's efforts. So are we saying that, say, Diana Taurasi, arguably the greatest WNBA player, Diana Taurasi would get dollar for dollar the same amount as, say, LeBron James? In a perfect world, is that the way that we would want to see it? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to pitch. I'm going to give an assist here. I'm going to give the ball over to Dr. Aga, and that's because she and again our colleague Dave Berry have a project that they've been working on, and I was privileged to hear some of what they had found at our most recent conference in San Francisco. So I'm going to let you go first, Nola, and then I'm happy to fill in the gaps too on this.
So the research that Jill's referring to is a project recently where we were looking at this comparison between the NBA and the WNBA. And so the question that you asked, Tony, is a great one, right? It's we're in our minds often always comparing men's and women's games for a variety of reasons, whether it's performance or whether it's pay. And so the question that we looked at was, should we be comparing the NBA right now in 2019 to the WNBA in 2019? Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the NBA has been around substantially longer than the WNBA. Mm-hmm. And because of that, if you were to flash back to like the 1950s, where the NBA had been in existence for 15-ish years, what did that league look like 15 years and 20 years into its existence? It looked very different than it does today.
Right.
So the idea is, should we be thinking about how NBA players were paid in that same life cycle, right? So how were NBA players paid 20 years into the league? And let's compare that to how WNBA players are being paid.
Right.
20 years into their league. And if we look at that, that's a much more rational comparison, because leagues, from all this research in the sport management side, it takes decades to develop a fan base. That often fandom is passed from parent to child and from grandparents sort of on down. And so you need at least one generation to develop a really strong fan base. Mm-hmm. I mean, the early NBA was playing in high school gyms, and you know, they were playing on roads and neutral venues because they couldn't even get enough local, you know, playing time. It was just insanely different than it was today. And so if we look at that comparison, then and you run the numbers, right? And those are numbers that I don't have at my fingertips. But that gives you a much better sense of what the pay equity should be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in general, today, the men's leagues, they make 55-ish percent of total league revenues. Women's leagues, women are making a much smaller percentage. Okay? And so at least if you're comparing it on a percentage basis, then you start to get a sense of, well, yeah, maybe there isn't this general sense of equality yet. But it's, anyway, it's tough. I mean, we've talked about, you know, even thinking about the CBAs and the world of soccer, there's not a lot of one-to-one comparisons.
Right.
But if we were to do that, it's the same idea even in the world of soccer. There's been men's soccer leagues for much longer than it has for women's leagues. The women's leagues have struggled with that support. The MLS had a billionaire owner who owned sort of half of the teams for at least a decade before that league could get up and running and become successful. And the women haven't had that same sort of investment. And so the women's soccer leagues are continuing to struggle and to find that person that could subsist the league for an entire generation until it's successful enough that it can pay that 55% plus of its revenues to its players. So minus that apples-to-apples comparison, you know, we'd love to see more equity, but there's a lot of variables you have to tease out first to kind of answer that question.
Got it.
And I would just tack on, we've been kind of dancing around Title IX issues through the whole conversation, but Title IX had obviously huge implications for the pipeline that feeds professional sport for women. But it wasn't a complete fix for the access problem, the pipeline problem between male and female athletes, again, sport by sport. We know a lot of females in high school choose to play basketball, choose to play volleyball. Of course, if they have height, on their side. They choose these sports, but they don't choose them in this at the same rate that, that the men or the boys do. And so Title IX has been successful up to a point, but it hasn't made the playing field equal in terms of access at a young age in learn-to-play programs and in high school programs that might feed to college, that might, you know, feed to ultimately pain in the pros. And it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, Tony, right? Because, you know, why would my high school daughter want to choose to play basketball when she knows because of the WNBA collective bargaining agreement, she's only going to make X amount of dollars, and she can make more than X amount of dollars if she just goes to school and gets a degree in economics, right?
Right.
So it's a multifaceted kind of really, it's a cultural and social puzzle mm-hmm. that we're getting, at least we're talking about it more.
And, right.
And that's one of the benefits of having this conversation around the performance of the U.S. women's national team is that we're talking about it more, and it's elevated and kind of our collective consciousness so that we can start thinking about, wow, is there more we could do to just create better access for women? And then also do what Dr. Aga and Dr. Barry are talking about. If we're going to compare two leagues, let's compare them in similar life cycles, mm-hmm. as Dr. Aga was talking about.
That makes perfect sense, because I didn't even think about that. And I'm sort of mad at myself for not thinking about that. I'm usually smarter than that. But you, everyone wants to make the apple that comparison, LeBron James versus Diana Taurasi or something like that. But it does make sense that you want to compare the life cycle of the so the WNBA has been around since what? I mean, I think it's the 2000s or something like that.
98.
When was it?
98. Late 90s,
right. So it makes sense. It just makes sense that you'd want to compare, you know, you would want to compare the WNBA wages versus NBA wages when the NBA wages were, you know, 20 years in or something like that, and see if you can draw conclusions about what should be paid there. That makes perfect sense. So,
and also, attendance at games. That's another point that people love to make when they're arguing this. But if you look back, and I know Dr. Barry has this data, and I'm not prepared to quote it, but if you look back at what the average attendance at an NBA game was 20 years into the league, it might be slightly higher than what we see in the WNBA, but it's not what it is now. And you know, these are things that are kind of lost in the noise when people are, you know, speaking from their own kind of bias and context about sport.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, what Dr. Harris just mentioned a few minutes ago also is that there's this, remember the social layer of this, which is that what we see on television and what people talk about in sport is what they deem to be important, which for the most part and historically has been men's sport. But now look at the Women's World Cup. We had, you know, record viewership in the United States. The women's team came back, and the attendance for these NWSL games is now double, sometimes triple, mm-hmm. as people. So all they needed was that small amount of access, that small opportunity to see these women play on television and to be wowed. And look what happens to attendance.
Right.
So when you think about demand and you think about what drives, you know, the interest in men's sports or women's sports, right? If all I hear and see and find on television is talk of the NBA and the NBA and the NBA. Well, guess what? People are going to go to NBA games. They're going to be interested and they're going to pay attention. And when you don't have that on the other side, you don't see the passion and the demand. And so this Women's World Cup was a fantastic social experiment to say, listen, guess what happens when you give somebody just a glimpse of amazingness? They don't care what gender it is. They're going to go and they're going to watch because it's fantastic. And so we see that reflected in the attendance numbers already. And so that goes back to the same idea of needing these social structures, needing media to pay equivalent attention, needing people to talk at equivalent, you know, rates about women's sports and men's sports, instead of the huge disparity that we see now. And that those small shifts in access can have enormous shifts on the ground in terms of gate revenue and everything else. And that also is what the women we're talking about in their lawsuit from March of this year, they said, listen, one of the things you're not even doing is you're not even announcing the games, the women's national team games, early enough that we can have good ticket sales.
Right.
And so they, I mean, that is even included in their lawsuit, which is you have to treat us equally, even in terms of the possibility of selling tickets and gaining access and maximizing revenues.
Yeah. To me, those are absolute dunks. Those are things that can be done now, right? Those are things that can be done now. Coverage, you know, I don't really see a lot of coverage of the games on the news. Lackluster coverage is just, you know, these are things that can be done now to help with this problem. So let's see, we want to be sensitive to your time. So as economists and sports economists with your broad research agenda in labor economics, econometrics, and anything, I mean, we talked about a lot of it already on the podcast, but if you had unlimited resources to convene economists, data scientists, and any others that you think that would help come up with a better solution, what would it be? It could be something that we've already talked about or something different. Dr.
That's Ott. A great question. That's a great question. Jill, do you have ideas?
Well, I'll pitch a couple things out. So first is more of a qualitative approach, and it gets to what Tony, you were just saying, you know, things that we can do, just creating more access, providing more coverage. I think that one of the things that needs to happen is, again, this kind of changing of the narrative, not to diminish this notion that there are laws that say, yes, equal pay for equal work. And I think that the women and their representatives are negotiating. They're being very savvy in the way that they have framed the wording of their lawsuit with the Federation. But I think that the narrative, again, should be kind of widened out, that let's not just talk about equal pay for equal work, but let's talk about what could be potentially more compensation if we really focused on the productivity issues. And so that leads to my, you know, if I had unlimited resources, well, there's a lot of things I would want to do, Tony, but on this issue, you know, we know a lot, we know an awful lot about on the sports economics side. Thanks to Bill Girard, back in 2006, he developed the model that most anybody in our business that's evaluating player performance for complex invasion sports like soccer, like basketball, is probably citing the work of Bill Girard. We know a lot in sports economics about how to identify the marginal productivity of players in complex invasion sports. And what I would like to see done, and I think it could help inform this decision process, is let's focus, let's kind of relook with all the tools that are at our disposal with these kinds of performance models. Let's take a look, one-for-one, as we've been talking about, at the performance of the women, and let's just maybe even talk about, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, and let's look at the performance of the men, and do that absent the revenue piece at first, and just get a good picture on what's happening on the pitch. And there are some studies that have already done this partially, but I think we could do it again with the new context that we have. And then secondly, if we had unlimited resources, yeah, we could maybe try to disentangle these sponsorship dollars and kind of separate out the fixed revenue from these kind of variable revenue streams and try as best we can to really get a good estimate of the marginal revenue product. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't guarantee that USSF would pay that to the women, but it would present some pretty concrete evidence that, you know, the players that generate the largest marginal revenue product should at least be earning a wage closer to the marginal revenue product that they generate. And you couple that with what our legal institutions say is supposed to happen in labor markets, and I think we get closer to a solution. And you know, we'd have some fun actually doing it, because I think there'd be a lot of people that would be quite surprised by who the most productive players are.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And along the same lines, I think I would go back to this core idea of what the U.S. Soccer Foundation is supposed to do, Federation is supposed to do, right? That they have this mission to promote the game of soccer in this country. And if that's the case, then they should be doing that for both the men's side and the women's side equally. It's a pipe dream, but in a perfect world, what you would do is your employees wouldn't be unionized by gender. Your employees might be unionized, but not by gender, right? And that you could then create a system that's equivalent. I mean, you look at the U.S. Open, you look at other tennis tournaments around the world that have decided that it actually makes a lot of sense to pay equal prize money to the men and women. And so it's the same idea that somehow that these payments are not tied to revenues, that the organization can have revenue streams wherever it wants. It can generate revenues from sponsors and from broadcasters and from licensing and from everything else, and that the organization's revenues are what they are. And now that you know what they are, you develop your player payment as a function of total revenues.
Yeah.
And total revenues regardless of source. And then you couple, you know, what Dr. Harris was talking about in terms of marginal revenue product. Now that we know what our total pool is, who are our most productive players and what are they worth? And so let's now value players for what they're worth, regardless of their gender, right? But as a function of their productivity. Some of these aren't realistic, you know, at least in terms of deunionizing, I guess, by gender. But in a perfect world, I think that would be the equitable way to look at this.
Yeah, those are very good ideas. I mean, and thanks for those. You know, I look at this in contrast to in endurance sports, right? So the Boston Marathon, New York City Marathon. So in the Boston Marathon, the winner of the Boston Marathon on the male side gets $150,000, and the female finisher, first finisher, gets $150,000. So, and it's the same.
It's,
yep, all the way down. The same with the Ironman World Championship. The male and female finisher, first finisher, gets $120,000 each, and then second, third, fourth is equal all the way down. They're able to do that because they've worked out the, you know, it's not the men's Boston Marathon or the women's Boston Marathon. It's just the Boston Marathon. And all the sponsorship is for that, right? And so maybe we can take a page from you know, competitive endurance sports, something like that. But I think you both have introduced some great ideas. And I think you know, we can put this podcast time capsule out out to the world, the economists and data scientists of the world, to come up with a better solution that might make people happy. So this has been a great podcast. Anything else that you guys thinking about that you'd want to offer to our listeners on this issue? I mean, I can think about so many other topics to talk to you guys about. There's maybe one day we can bring you guys back to talk about the idea of pay for NCAA athletes. That's another hot one.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And probably as complicated.
Yeah, and equally. Well, you've got gender issues in there as well, but people are equally passionate, right? And it's equally as polarizing as you talked about in the beginning.
Right.
You have these very kind of polarized groups and positions. I'd be happy to come back and talk. I think if there was one other item I would want to kind of embed in your listeners' minds, because I'm assuming that your listeners are pretty vested in sport or at least interested in sport.
Right.
But one thing that we, and I'm pretty sure Dr. Aga has to do this as well, but especially in economics, the discipline writ large, those of us that do work in sports economics find ourselves sometimes defending this choice because it seems somewhat niche or kind of boutique that you would research these questions. But there's two advantages of looking at phenomena and behavior in sport. One is that data is plentiful, and we make that case all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as technology increases, right? We do have lots of ways to kind of track and estimate estimate productivity. And we're getting better and better access. It's not complete access, not perfect access to good data about revenues, costs, things like that. So the data is plentiful. But this, the second kind of advantage of investigating behavior and decisions and performance in sport is that, and I know you agree with this, sport and performance is a microcosm of what's happening in the broader culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the things that we can learn from looking at pay disparity in professional sports or in amateur sports, you know, across the NCAA, things like that, is it really uncovers these kind of broader questions that are of import to everyone. Everyone, certainly in free societies, you know, anybody that's participated in the labor market, anybody who's ever gone to work for anyone, anybody who's raising children, there, you know, what we learn from studying sport has direct kind of generalizations to bigger, broader social, cultural questions. And that was my pitch for sports economics research.
Right, right.
I mean, the only thing I'll add is a huge thank you to you for taking the time to talk about these issues and to bring them to light and to continue to give voice to these really important conversations that we have, because as Jill said, they do have implications for larger society, and it's important that we continue to discuss them and continue to make these improvements for the world around us.
Oh, thank you. I'm just fortunate that you guys would agree to talk to me. And I didn't have to go break out my microeconomics book from Boston College to talk to you guys.
Do you still have that, Tony? You should sell that right now.
So where can people find you on the internet, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram? How could people find you, your research, your papers, your books?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, early adopter, so it's just at Jill Harris.
Nice, you got that.
Isn't that awesome?
That's awesome.
So I tend to post current research. I do have a website that is a little more, it has my research there, but it also is kind of curated more for what I teach. But people are more than welcome to visit, and it's Jill S. Harris, PhD.com.
And I am not an early adopter, but I am the only Nola Aga in the world as far as I know, and so you can also find me on Twitter at Nola Aga. I'm also at the University of San Francisco. If you type in my name on Google, like I said, I'm pretty sure I'm the only one that comes up, and you'll find my research listed there or on LinkedIn.
Great. Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great. Take care.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Dr. Aga and Dr. Harris for lending us their time and talking to us about the wage gap in professional sports. I hope you learned something, as I certainly have. And as I stated in the beginning, you almost certainly shift a little bit from where you are on your spectrum. I know I have, just by having that discussion and doing the research and such and reading the class action lawsuit and all of it. So I hope we can have them back. I can think of so many topics that fall within the intersection of sport, health, fitness, and life, and economics that we can talk to Dr. Harris and Dr. Aga about, or even have a part two on this topic. So I guess you're, you know, wondering what you can do. If you've ever watched Megan Rapinoe's interviews, they always ask her the same question. What can we do to help? And she always states in her interviews, look, you can go to the games. You can buy the jerseys. You can buy the merchandise. You can watch the games. You can get involved. And that's some things that we can all do to help out women's soccer. Thanks again for your time, and this is the Endurance Experience Podcast.
Follow
with Bent Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services to become a member of our Endurance Institute, or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.